Hello, everyone, and welcome to another edition of Troy News is an Absolute Podcast. I'm your host, as always, John Casillo, and with me today is Dan Lyons.
Hey, happy it's not their fault. They didn't know week.
Yeah, I think it's both. I think, you know, they work separately. This was definitely a both game. Some games we're going to have it's a not their fault game. Others we're going to have it's they didn't know games. Against BC, it might be both yet again.
Yeah, I mean, I would assume BC knows now, but it still might not be their fault. Their lack of fault being that they don't possess an offense.
Yes, and that also assumes that they includes Steve Adazio. I don't know if they is just the team, if it's just the coach. I'm sure this hopefully this debate happens next week when we see who is they and whose fault is it.
our new weekly segment.
New weekly segment. Who's at fault?
Do you watch BoJack Horseman?
Of course I do.
What's the game show from last season? Celebrities.
Hollywood stars and celebrities. Do they know things? What do they know?
What do they know? How? Yes.
Whose house is this?
That is a reference that maybe 8 of our listeners will understand. You should all watch BoJack Horseman.
Yeah, it's like the most depressingly funny show on television.
Yes, which is saying something. There's many now. And it also has a horse person, yeah. Played by Will Arnett.
He drinks a lot. It's a great television program.
It's honestly not that much different than just general Syracuse fandom put into a Netflix cartoon. It's about fame and not rooting for Syracuse.
That's why we get to. That's why we probably relate to it.
we feel BoJack's his strife within us. Except we just want to watch like a football team that can go sits like on a bad year. And he just wants to grow his legacy from a bad sitcom.
Yeah, and admittedly, I also enjoy the show because of all the kind of Los Angeles-based Easter eggs that get tossed in there quite a bit. It's, again, very entertaining program. Highly recommend for those who don't watch it on Netflix.
I don't know how we got here in the first 3 minutes of this podcast, but we did, so.
That's fine.
Good on us.
Good on us. Like we were saying on Twitter on Wednesday, because for those who were wondering where the hell the podcast was on Thursday, technical difficulties scuttled the ship. We were saying that this was our first kind of quote-unquote big win podcast in quite some time, since the Minnesota game in the Texas Bowl in 2013. So we kind of didn't know what to do with ourselves, since this is kind of uncharted territory, since the podcast kind of entered its current format. I'd say, you know, 2013 we were still in a very much kind of trial and error, let's see what worked. I think now at this point we're in year 4 of this thing, we have a bit of a groove going. I don't think we know how to properly celebrate on this show, Dan.
No, I mean, and even referring to Minnesota as like a big run, like, I mean, I think winning a bowl game for Syracuse is always a nice thing. I've always enjoyed it the 3 times I've seen it happen. But really, like, this is the biggest win the program realistically has had since that Louisville game in 2012, where they blitzkrieged. I mean, I guess Teddy Bridgewater actually had a really nice game, but they just, like, ran through that program that ended up beating Florida in the Sugar Bowl, if I'm not mistaken. It was a big day. And Virginia Tech, I heard some people saying, oh, maybe they weren't the number 17 team. There was no evidence of that heading in. Virginia Tech looked good in pretty much every game it played up to this point, including like that Tennessee team that they lost to is super talented and was very healthy then, unlike the team that lost Alabama last weekend, which had like 11 big injuries. That Tennessee team, even if they're not like a playoff team, that's like a top 10 program probably. And Vatek hunted with them in their like second game under their new coach for a good 2.5 quarters. So this is a very good team. And like Tino said, apparently they just didn't know. And we didn't know either, because we both picked Syracuse to lose by like 20 points.
That's fine.
Which is fine. Like, we didn't have any evidence that they were going to do what they did.
No.
Coming off of that awful game against Wake Forest, which obviously had mitigating circumstances that will hopefully not repeat themselves this weekend. It was just an awesome game. I actually didn't see any of it live. I didn't see it until Monday. I was obviously like following it on my phone. I was like, oh, this game's probably not going to be great. I had friends in town. We went to brunch. I actually had the College Football Saturday off for the first time in probably 3 years. So I was like, you know what? I'm just going to distance myself from football today. Just take a nice Saturday off for once.
Ooh.
And I watched like the second half of Wisconsin-Ohio State at the bar later on. But like, I was just like, yeah, I can't really put this on. Like, they're winning. And I just expected it to implode, and I was like following Twitter and stuff, and it just happened. So I guess I can't watch any more games.
Yeah, you're banned. Although, yeah, I think the only person who hasn't been banned this season, I think you've been banned, Sean's been banned. I, on the other hand, the only game that I missed, we lost in astounding fashion. So maybe I should not be banned.
Which one did you miss, the Louisville game?
Oh, no, I missed the Wake game.
Oh, I mean, astounding is one way to put that.
Yeah. life ending.
Wet.
Wet.
Wet fashion. It was quite wet.
Drizzly.
Socky fashion.
Yes. So I don't know. Where do we want to go first on this game? Because, Dan, give me some of your perspective watching the game on Monday after knowing what happened, 2 days before.
I wish I had watched it live because the suspense was totally drained from it. I had seen like the big plays, but I really like stayed, I read a lot of stuff, but I really had stayed distance from it until I watched the full game on Monday morning. It was impressive because it didn't look out of place. Like, you know, where you see a team that just finds life and they have this big upset and it's like one of those video game, like the Madden games, where like the computer is just going to win no matter what, and that's what it seems like the underdog is doing.
Yeah, the Iowa State-Oklahoma State game in like 2000.
Yeah, exactly. And you're like, I know this team is definitively worse than this other team, but they just cannot make a mistake, and they're going to win because it's just not, it's just, that's what's happening right now. This looks like a regular football game. Syracuse made a number of mistakes. They had some questionable play calling, one set of downs in particular that I know you had a stroke over, which, and I defend it, like, I don't blame you after watching it. Syracuse just looked like these were two teams that were, like, fairly evenly matched, and Syracuse outplayed them, and that could have happened, like, it looked like a game where, like, Syracuse would have won that matchup 60% of the time, and you're like, oh, that's just a better team at home. They won by 2 touchdowns. Great. It, like, didn't look like anything out of the ordinary, which is almost more exciting, because it wasn't like they played their A game, even. I thought they probably played, like, their B-plus game, and they just, that was enough to beat a pretty good Virginia Tech team handily, which is really exciting.
Yeah, I mean, you even, like, if you want to take that a bit further, even into the advanced statistics end of it, like, I know I saw on Bill Connolly's, like, advanced stats page, I think the offense performed at, like, maybe an 81st percentile, and the defense was, like, at a 58th, which...
Which for that defense is really good.
Yeah, but like you think about it, like if that was the defense at a 58th percentile, and that's what they were able to do, and that's who they were able to stop at a 58th percentile, like you can definitely pick up what Dino Babers is putting down at this point. You know, if you want to even, you know, just not even on a sight test, but on a metrics test, like if that's us at not even 75%, I'm very, very excited for what happens when this team really rounds into itself.
And we've been talking about this for a couple weeks now. The defense is like, especially because it's hard to forget what happened in that Notre Dame game, what happened in Louisville, although Louisville does what they did to us more often than not at this point. But this defense is coming along, and it doesn't really make a lot of sense because it's very banged up. There's no depth. U of Dyes playing effectively out of position, and they just look like they're just coming along. Wake game, obviously, there isn't a ton to glean from it based on the conditions, but they played pretty well there. Notre Dame, we talked, like, it's probably sounded at the time like we were really trying to put lipstick on a pig, but based on how most of that game went, but they made some nice stands.
Yeah, they made some strides over the course of that game.
Yeah, at UConn was a nice performance. Virginia Tech is an all, like, that, the 59 percentile side, like, they made some huge plays. They forced Evans into, what, his second pick of the year,
mm-hmm.
In a really big spot near the end zone.
And that fumble later.
And the fumble later, yeah, they were opportunistic. They basically did the things that this cover two defense, along with this offense, is designed to do. Like, they played the game that is of the design that this defense is intended for, which is exciting. And it should only get better because you're going to get, obviously, just dies back from injury eventually, maybe not this year, but next year. And then you're going to get players who actually fit the defense, which, as we've been harping on all year, is just really not the case with the personnel we have. So the fact, I honestly, like, I don't want to make it sound like this defense is going to be like amazing next year. It may never be amazing just based on how the offense plays, statistically at least. But I think you can give a lot of credit to the defensive staff because they're clearly doing something right over the course of the season, and they are putting their players in an opportunity to make plays. And it's done leaps and bounds better than what it was in South Florida and Louisville. So that's very exciting.
100%. And I think like it's interesting you're seeing – you know, I was talking to Julian Wiggum about this, too, when I was speaking with him last week. And for those who didn't read the article, Julian put up a great article on Wednesday, breaking down the defense a little bit and, you know, talking about this improvement as well. And it's great to get his thoughts since, you know, his experience in college was with the old defense and Scott Schaefer's system. You're seeing a little bit of the old system kind of wiggling its way into the new one, but not the bad habits. You're seeing a lot crisper tackling over the last few weeks. And you're seeing us being able to, you know, force turnovers and doing it in a way that plays to their strengths. The linebackers right now, and I think in the future, are going to be the kind of the strength of this group. It would be nice to have a little support from the line and the defensive backs. And that's kind of, you know, where you see the division between the first few games and the last few games is that you really weren't getting much of a push on the front. You were letting up a lot of big plays in the secondary. In the last couple games, like, you really didn't see a ton of, I mean, it happened here and there, but you weren't seeing the same amount of receivers getting by our defensive backs. And this is with, you know, second and third string guys looking at, like, the spring game too deep. You know, you got guys like Carl Jones playing significant minutes, guys like Christopher Frederick playing significant minutes, you know, instead of, like, some of our best players on the defense, Dowles, Cordy, Cordell Hudson hasn't really been in. There's a lot of other freshmen that have been injured. Rodney Williams seems like he's stepping up. And Zaire Franklin, really, I mean, he was a guy that, you know, we talked about in the season preview podcast as someone who really needed to get it for this defensive scheme to work. And he understands it. He's still not, you know, an expert in coverage. And that's what the traditional middle linebacker role is for this Tampa 2. But, you know, he's found a way to not disadvantage the coverage while still making plays at the line of scrimmage in the backfield. I mean, he's made big fourth down stops now, 2 weeks in a row, two or three weeks in a row now. And this team's ability to make stops in the red zone, make stops inside the 10. I mean, again, they're not an all-worldly group, but they're a hell of a lot better than the, like, probably bottom 10 group that we saw in those first probably three games.
Yeah, the Franklin point's a really good point, because like you said, he's still adjusting, and you see, like, here and there are lapses in coverage, but then he made that awesome, he was the one who deflected the pass in the air that was picked off late, I believe, right?
Yeah,
so he got his hand on that, which was a nice read play. I honestly, like, Franklin's made some huge plays this year, the UConn game last week and this week. It's not crazy to think he should be on, like, some maybe third team all-ACC consideration. Like, he's had a really nice year. And then the other play that really struck out, similar in terms of, like, read and react, Rodney Williams' pick was awesome. Like, he baited the quarterback into that throw, which and kind of comes out of nowhere, pops into the screen, and just makes an awesome play in the end zone. So really good to see those guys, like, starting to understand, like, the instincts required and make these big plays in coverage, where the last defense, and this isn't, like, a comparison over, like, which is a better approach. I think they both have their uses, and we add some really, really good defenses under Schaefer. But it's just a big switch. Like, the last defense was very predicated on getting pressure and making big plays there. This one is bend, don't break, making big interceptions, forcing fumbles, taking advantage on the back end, and not allowing big plays. So very different schemes. And as we've noted pretty much consistently this season, like, the as big as the offensive adjustment is going to be, the defensive one is not to be understated, and we're definitely seeing progress on both ends, which is exciting. I think this weekend, obviously, it being a big upset helps, but I think even beyond, like, the score of the game and the emotion and the locker room antics afterwards, like, you saw very meaningful advancement just on a play-by-play basis, which is awesome to see, and hopefully both those things continue to come together, and we get, you know, the fans that are excited. You really can't ask for much more pub than what Syracuse has got, which I think Babers, as much as he's going to deny that that's what he was doing, like, it became very clear to me after, like, the 18th time I watched that video. Babers definitely understood the camera was there and definitely knew this was his shot this year to get some attention on Syracuse for good reasons, and he just, like, absolutely leaned into it and did everything he could to make this as big a moment as it could be. And I think he did it with to great effect. Because it's been a story all week, which is kind of crazy because, like, we've had upsets like this before in the last couple of years where it, like, wasn't – it didn't blow up like this.
No, not at all. And I think it goes to show, you know, you look at the different PR styles of we've had, you know, similar PR from a university standpoint, from an athletic standpoint, but where you see a little bit of difference is where the coaching style and his PR efforts. I think Marrone was, you know, win him over with – I think at first it was win him over with kindness and kind of, you know, it's on me, take the bullets for, you know, his alma mater and all this, and that eventually led to success. I think Schaefer, success early on as he kind of preached, you know, continuity, tough guy attitude, and that eventually led to, like, maybe not as much in touch with reality in terms of where the program was and a bit of a gruff exterior with the media. Babers, I think it's in part him. I mean, he was holding court at ACC Media Days, having Wildhack come in, given his background at ESPN, are both huge draws. But I think what he's done, he's a bit of a P.T. Barnum type, you know, referencing any PR 101 book for those who have been in PR 101. He's a bit of a, like, you know, come see the show type guy, and he's not going to create bluster around things that don't deserve it, but when there is, he knows the moment, he's going to capture it. And if SU loses every game for the rest of the year, you might not remember the Virginia Tech upset around the country, you might not remember anything about the game, but you're going to remember that video, and there's no way in hell he didn't know that.
Yeah, I also think it helps that Babers, especially compared to Schaefer, really has the college football media on his side. Like, he's this personality where people already knew him from Bowling Green. He wasn't, like, a huge name, but people knew, oh, this guy had really good teams in the MAC. And those who really pay attention to college football, you know, watch those two Falcon teams play really well, but they kind of had an idea of his personality going in. And he's definitely not nearly as standoffish with the media as Schaefer was, and didn't have, like, the Atlanta gaffe, which I still don't think was that big a deal, but was made a very big deal. So he just doesn't have that baggage. So you have people who have no interest in Syracuse totally buying in because he runs an awesome offense. It's fun to watch and easy to write about and support. And then he has a good personality, and it all really came together this past weekend.
Completely agree. And switching, I guess, gears a little bit to one negative, and then we switch back to positive. Dan, did you know that you'd be walking into that drive beforehand, or was that something like no one had mentioned to you because of the win? Four and out on the 1 yard line.
I was watching with my roommate who watched most of the game live, and I think I was aware of it. I don't think I knew exactly where it was, but I think after the first two plays, I was like, is this the one where we get totally stopped from like 2 yards out? And we just ran some bullshit the whole time. And he's like, yeah. And then I was like, oh, I really wonder. I was like, John must have lost his mind. And he's like, yeah, you should go see his Twitter feed. I was like, okay.
Yeah, it was that was my low point of the Babers era so far, where I was kind of just unloading like every frustration that I had. And like, admittedly, like no one, like, and that's the thing, the internet remembers everything, but no one's gonna remember that. Unless, like, things go south and then, or if things go really well, like, and someone decides that they wanted to, you know, catch all my tweets about, like, the one time that I decided to come unglued about this. Because, to be honest, like, I think I've been incredibly supportive. The whole staff has been really, really supportive. I think we're really supportive of Schaefer, to be honest, when there was something to support. Like, when it comes to Babers.
We were very supportive of Schaefer for a good, like, year and a half, and then...
And then the tough guy speak started, and
yeah,
like that's the thing. Like the only thing I took issue with was if we're and I said this on the last couple of podcasts, and we fixed it this week was if you're gonna say you're aggressive, then go for it on fourth down, then don't settle for 50-yard field goals. And like we did half of that. I think going for it on fourth down five times was awesome. Making, you know, completing four of those conversions was even better. And those extended drives, those helped us put up points, those helped us win the game. I hope that that's more of what we see going forward versus what we saw in, you know, the last few games. I know in particular, The UConn, I think everything from the USF game until this past week was, there was a whole lot of reservations on fourth down. We weren't taking the risks we needed to. If we wanted to win games, we wanted to turn the page in the program. We did see it against Virginia Tech, which is awesome. I know I won't say much more about the you know, four plays from the one. I know you weren't at the Iowa game, but it took me back to that Iowa game. And as I've told people numerous times, that was my I watched SU for years. That was my first in-game experience. My first game as a student was seeing that. And for me, it's a trigger point of, and it takes me right back to sitting in a sweltering hot dome facing a ranked Iowa team that we should have knocked off, we could have knocked off, and instead we didn't. And to me, I thought those days are over. I thought that that type of offensive attack was over. And to see, you know, five wide from the one when just sucking it up and putting in Fredericks or, you know, using Cam McPherson as an extra blocker like we did later on when Dungy scored from the one and really kind of used him to just set a pick and let Dungy squeeze in. It was very, very frustrating to watch. But again, like this was the first game that I really felt notes were taken, adjustments were made, and SU got to really, especially on offense, got to address a lot of the issues that we saw in the first half. I mean, I said it in the play call breakdown. SU got to at least the Virginia Tech 40 on every single drive in the second half. And I mean, that's absolutely stunning. I mean, we still have more to go. If you look at Bill Connolly's numbers, our third down offense is one of the 10 worst, the third quarter offense, excuse me, is one of the 10 worst in the entire country. But our first quarter offense is one of the top 25 in the country. So if we can find a way to even those two things out, then we're starting to make headway. But I think we started to see the progress in the positive direction this past week.
Yeah, and going back to what I said before, like it wasn't like Syracuse played a perfect game. You had that just terrible drive, well, not full drive, the terrible goal line set of downs. And there was just like a number of things during the game where, you know, I was pretty sure, or I would have been pretty sure if I had watched it live, but like there was probably three or four things that was like, well, we're definitely losing. This means we're losing. We're not going to withhold of this lead. It wasn't like just like the West Virginia game on the Friday night of the, or that Louisville game where once Syracuse got control, it just never didn't know what they could do. Never in doubt. This was not that game. It seemed like more of a normal football game, which makes me, like I said, like almost a little more excited about how it turned out. And that was definitely it. Like that, it could have been a three-touchdown win if Syracuse had called anything remotely effective in that drive, and that was very frustrating. I guess that was like the one point where I was not allowed. I knew the result before I watched because I would have been like pulling my hair out as well. I almost did anyway. Like it was really bad. Like, it wasn't like, oh, they ran four plays and dots. Like it was like, nope, perplexing.
You went, nope, you went
why
five,
they were doing the things they were doing.
Nope, you went five wide on two out of three plays, and then finally you decided, oh, maybe we should run this. Yeah, you know what though? I feel like I said, I don't know Babers well enough to know if he's a stubborn guy. I feel like most coaches are, but I do applaud the changes that were made and the fixes that were implemented. I did feel like, again, the offense just looked better in the second half. I do think that's a big plus. You know, I know you said SU could have won by another touchdown. I think SU could have won by 20 more points if you look at what was left on the board. I mean, Murphy missed another two field goals, but at this point, like, are we setting him up? And this isn't criticizing the staff. This is more just a general point. And I don't want anyone to take it as me like setting the special teams on fire. At what point are we undermining Murphy's ability to get it back together? I don't think any field goal kicker should be put in a position in college, especially where he's got to hit two or three 50 yarders a game. Because he's going to miss two. He's probably going to miss at least one of those, if not two. I mean, the fact that Murphy's talented enough to hit one of them at all is great. But I feel like we're eroding his confidence by putting him in these positions to constantly try to hit 50-yarders.
Yeah, that certainly was one of the other confusing parts of the game. And it's unfortunate because Murphy was quite reliable last year and for the first couple games this year. And in the last couple of weeks, he's been a total mess. So I do hope they find a way to they find a way to get him, you know, back in a groove. And kicking obviously is so mental. You see it in the NFL, like guys will be consistent for like 3 years and then they have one string of bad games and they get cut. There's just clearly a lot there that we don't understand just as people who haven't done it. And I think that's the case for a lot of like football coaching staffs, to be honest. There just isn't always a focus on special teams. So hopefully ours has some ideas as to how to get Murphy back. Cause, you did see like the 150 yarder he hit. He was like overjoyed after he hit it. So hopefully that, you know, gives him some confidence even when he did have the other misses.
The thing is, he's got a strong enough leg for it. Like, and that's the rough part is that that's when you know it's mental, not physical, is when he has the leg for these 50-yard kicks every time. It's just, it's the accuracy piece, and it's, I mean, that the fact that it was not just a 50-yard, the one that was not just a 50-yard field goal, but it was a rushed 50-yard field goal at the end of the play clock and didn't need to be, that's what killed me, and it's something that, I brought up again in the play call breakdown is, yeah, if we could avoid doing that going forward, that'd be awesome.
Yeah, and it's, if it was just 50 yarders that he was like only hitting a third of, I get that. Those are tough kicks, but it's the fact that we were using him in those situations, despite the fact that he has like a slew of like what he has one or two missed or blocked extra points and has a couple of really like chip shot field goals that he's missed that he was hitting every time last year. So it's like you have all those, and then you're also having him trying a 53 yarder with the clock winding down. Like maybe let's just run a play and see what happens and get him some easy kicks and build his confidence back up. But, you know, maybe hitting that 50-yarder is what was more important, and he got that under his belt. So we'll see. We'll see what happens going forward. Hopefully it doesn't cost us a game, because that would be really unfortunate, especially because wins down the stretch, even with this Virginia Tech win and how, you know, much better we feel about the team, like, I still think we're a real uphill battle here to even sniff 6 wins. I think 5 might honestly be, like, the hard cap, so... We'll see. I do hold out hope, because he did put like a great season last year. So hopefully he can return to being that guy consistently.
Yeah, I mean, we'll see. I haven't looked to see if that quality control special teams assistant job is still up. But I mean, we've seen some levers pushed on special teams since, you know, I was kind of taking the special teams to task after the UConn game. You know, we inserted Brizzly Esteem back into the punt return role primarily, and it kills me that he was ever removed from it for any point in time, because A, the defense, while improved, still isn't good enough to force more than like what, 5 punts a game. And B, like he's still making a bigger impact on the offense now in the last few weeks and making a bigger impact on special teams. I mean, Brizzly's best trait has always been his ability to flip the field. And, you know, he started doing that in the Texas Bowl against Minnesota, where he set us up for what ended up being the game-winning touchdown. I'm puzzled as to what caused any switch of Brizzly out of his primary role and the role that he's gotten all-conference acclaim for, but it's not worth harping on anymore. He's back in that role, and it was great to see him yet again, you know, set us up with a short field that ended up, you know, kind of sealing the game with that last touchdown.
Yeah, we called for it after he had the one big return a couple games ago. Like, that needs to be him. I don't care if it costs him a couple plays at the beginning of a drive. Syracuse is going on enough extended drives where he's going to be on the offense most of the time. And this week, great example. This is his biggest week on offense by far this year. We mentioned, I was saying that I was really hoping he would find a bigger role in the offense, and it seems like they've done that. Especially this, I don't know what they saw in this matchup, but he and Phillips just absolutely tore up Virginia Tech. I don't know if Virginia Tech has that big a drop between their like outside and inside corners, but their nickel and dime backs were just getting roasted, and it proved that like Risley can return punts and you can get him back out there and he can be effective. So hopefully that is the game plan going forward.
Much agreed. On that note, Dan, what have you been drinking for the last week?
So I had some decent new stuff. Or newish stuff this week. I had a friend bring back down a thing of Switchback Ale from Vermont, so I drank a lot of that, which is pretty solid. Nothing like game changery or at all, but a very nice, you know, standard, very drinkable ale. And then I had Avery has a Gosa, which was solid. I wrote on Untappd. It wasn't my favorite of the style, and it wasn't my favorite Avery, but, like, it was very, very solid. Would definitely drink it again. And Avery, like, just made stood beer, so I wasn't surprised it was quite good. And then the best thing I had from Breakside Brewery, which is out in Portland, Oregon, I think, they have a passion fruit sour ale that was absolutely delicious. Like, just a really good sour, but nothing, you know, it was incredibly drinkable. I could have had a number of those. I kept myself to one. But that was really, really good and kind of unexpected, just how good that was. So I'll definitely be looking out for that one again. I don't think I'd ever seen more, you know, Breakside around here, but obviously there are a couple places around here that did a lot of West Coast stuff and a lot of rarer stuff. So that was awesome.
Interesting. Yeah, I gotta look that one up. Some things that I had. I stopped over to my favorite spots around here for longtime listeners. That'd be Smog City and Monkish over in Torrance. Tried the Dry Hop Sour Blonde over at Smog City. I mentioned Snugglebug and Cuddlebug and Chinooks and Crannies, among some other sours that Smog City's made. The base beer for that is this this Sour Blonde that they decided to dry hop. Excellent, excellent beer. One of my favorite IPAs made in L.A., Amarillo Gorilla was back. I'd try some of that. Monkish has been releasing some IPAs every other week or so. And the one that they decided to go with after the Dodgers' first-round victory was called L.A. Hat. It was made with Citra, Mosaic hops. Very good. Again, they make East Coast-style IPAs, so a nice change of pace for us out here. Then also came home and had an actual East Coast-style IPA from Treehouse. A friend of mine sent me a can of Julius. That was pretty fresh. Much enjoyed. Also on the East Coast IPA train, had a Sea Hag IPA from New England Brewing. Same friend sent that. And then enjoyed some stuff from the brewery. The Grade was a Baltic Porter made with maple syrup. And then Mash and Vanilla was a barley wine. And bourbon barley is barley wine with vanilla. Very, very good variant on mash, which the brewery makes a lot of use of. I have two bottles of mash and coconut, actually, in my fridge that I'll be cracking open soon enough. Very excited to try those.
Very nice.
Indeed. All right. So, next game, Boston College. This is the only game this year that we are, well, second game this year, UConn being the other, that we are going to kind of exuberantly look down on the other team, at least going in. Even if we lose, I still feel much better about SU's place in the world versus BC's. Don't you, Dan?
Yeah. I think, was it on BCI where they put up a long post about how, like, this was kind of like the game for Adazio and, like, it was trying to make or break for him?
I felt really bad for AJ. I was like, I read this article. I'm like, dude, this is like the darkest timeline. Like, I don't even write shit like this.
And, like, I think part of it is that, like, Adazio had more success up front. He had, like, what, two bowl games? It was basically, like, if you had an extra year of, like, 2013 Schaefer before everything fell apart. So, like, you have more invested in him. It's harder to then, like, get away. You're, like, worried that even another bad year will buy you another year. With Schaefer, we were pretty reasonably certain that it was going to be it, and it was.
And he also only had a year left on his contract. Adazio was extended to 2020.
Right. So I get it. It's tough when you see, like, a team like Syracuse. Like, Syracuse and BC are similar-ish teams in terms of ability this year, and Syracuse pulled a 31-17 upset of Virginia Tech, a team that beat BC 49-0 earlier in the year. And it's hard to, and obviously we're Syracuse fans, so we're a little biased, but, like, it's hard to look at both teams and say that one is not going in a much better direction than the other.
Oh, completely. And, I mean, you just look at the recruiting rankings. I mean, despite the fact that Adazio is got them out of the funk that they were in under Spaziani, you know, in year one, he took in a senior-laden team, and, you know, Andre Williams was an absolute machine, to an 8-5 record. You know, in year two, slight drop as a lot of those seniors left. I think they had, like, 18 senior starters or something on the first year. Second year, you know, you saw a little bit of a dip. To 7-6, and that third year, everybody, all the upperclassmen were gone from his first two. He didn't really recruit that well. He was looking like, you know, 60s or so, and that team tripped and fell pretty hard on offense. And again, like, they don't really, BC has not yet shown an ability to develop a quarterback. Like, since Chase Reddick graduated, we're now 3 years removed, and they haven't, I mean, and that's, you know, coming from us, who had the same problem after Nassib left for the most part. And now, you know, they once again go in with a mercenary in Patrick Toles, who I don't think is that great. He's, you know, marginally accurate. He's marginally good at throwing football more than 20 yards. Like, there was a reason he didn't work out of Kentucky, and, like, he's a good stopgap. But again, like, if BC doesn't show an ability to develop quarterback talent, like, that's a real problem in the ACC, where, you know, even the defensively minded teams can put up points, and if you can't move the ball through the air, you're going to be hard. I mean, again, just get a guy. I mean, again, this is a bad example because he would transfer as well, but a guy like Nate Peterman over at Pitt, he can move the ball through the air with enough confidence that it doesn't hurt the running game being the staple. BC has just ignored, you know, recruiting on offense for far too long, and it's becoming their identity, which is bad. And I'm glad that SU, despite the fact that our offense has been terrible for a few years, we're still able to recruit skill players that can make an impact.
Yeah, it's almost like BC bought so far into just being this, like, awesome defensive team that they just haven't paid attention to trying to field an offense. And you don't have to go, like, full bore like Syracuse did with Babers, but, like, at least try to do something that resembles, like, a modern effective offense. Like, this is what, and this is not to compare these two programs at all. This is what buried Les Miles. Like, Les Miles got fired because he absolutely refused to make adjustments on offense, and, like, after he was on the chopping block, brought back the same coordinator and ran the same old offense that hadn't been effective for 6 or 7 years, and got fired 3 weeks in. So, like, obviously Boston College is an LSU, but, like, eventually you got to start doing something new and not just throwing stuff out there and be like, oh, our defense will give up 13 points a game, because honestly, like, BC's defense is good, but it's not as good as it was last year, and last year's defense only got it to, what, 3 or 4 wins? So, right.
3 wins and none in conference. Same as this year so far.
Oh.
And Les was doing it, and David Shaw's doing it at Stanford and Michigan State to an extent with 3 and 4-star guys. Like, you're doing it with more talent where you're leaning on a defense. Leaning on a defense doesn't necessarily work as well when you're leaning on 2 and 3-star guys on both sides. Like, again, you look at Stanford, like, and especially LSU. I mean, the reason that Les was fired was because he had 4 and 5-star guys that he was doing nothing with on offense. But you're seeing right away that putting in a competent offense under Orgeron sees results, because those guys, coincidentally, you know, are talented, can score points, can move the football. Adazio, by ignoring the offense and recruiting 2 and 3-star guys exclusively, that's kind of where, you know, the entire enterprise loses steam very quickly.
Yeah, I mean, this is why you have to go for, like, when you're a team like Syracuse or BC, which exists in very similar recruiting footprints, although for whatever reason we don't seem to recruit against them as much as you'd think for the same guys, but still in the same situation. Like, there's one team that's going to try to bunker in our defense, and they, this isn't to mention that we haven't even mentioned the loss of their defensive coordinator in Michigan last year. So the fact that they're even as good on defense this year as they have been is almost, like, lucky. Like, they have a lot of the same personnel, but when you lose a coordinator, like, it can totally throw you off. Syracuse is going for the full, like, hey, take advantage of the dome. We're going to go with the trendiest thing we could be doing right now, a team, something that isn't being run anywhere near here. We're starting to see some attention to pay to it now. I know there's that Pete Thamel piece, but, like, there are 4 teams in the whole nation out of 128 or 29 now running this Baylor's offense. There are some similar offenses, but there's only 4 running this exact thing. I bet that number doubles in the next, like, 2 years. But Syracuse is out ahead of it pretty quickly. BC, you know, if they make a move, they're going to be almost behind the 8-ball. And you're then betting that you're going to be able to recruit even at the level that Syracuse is, which isn't, like, great, but it's still a decent
improving
amount better. Yeah. It's, like, a decent, like, tier better based on the last couple of years. So this is all to say that I kind of get where AJ was coming from, and I get the bleakness, even if it isn't totally apparent just looking at BC from a distance. I can see where you feel bad. And then, you know, just looking at the results this year, like, they're good enough to beat the bad teams pretty handily, but the three games against teams that are as good or better than them, they absolutely blew the Georgia Tech game, where they actually, according to Bill C's numbers, they had a 79% win expectancy and lost. Like, that's hard. And then, obviously, Vatek ran them out of the stadium, and Clemson ran them out of the stadium. So that's not great. Like, this is... It reminds me of the Schaefer years. Like, maybe they'll beat the good team, the bad teams that they're supposed to beat by decent margins, but the second you face a team that has an advantage on you, like, talent-wise, there's just no shot.
Right. And, yeah, and this is kind of... I mean, BC fans are... It's totally fair for them to see this as the game that dictates Adazio's tenure in the season, because... if you can't beat SU, you're probably not going to be able to beat Wake Forest. Granted, there's a bit of a scheme difference, and I think that, you know, I've said this numerous times, and so have you, is that the speed of the SU system definitely creates an advantage against a slower plotting team like BC. But that said, if you're BC, you're looking at a 5-7 ceiling when Vegas said that you were winning no less than 6.5 games. I mean, Vegas was wrong, and you and I said they were wrong during the summer, because you looked at that BC schedule and 3-9 was on the table. Well, here we are. That's not the, you know, I told you so, the whole damn thing. But it's to say, there was never any evidence that this year was going to be some sort of, you know, landslide, like just change in culture and ability for this BC squad. And, you know, you brought up recruiting a little bit, like, even under Schaefer, and this doesn't account for all of the attrition and everything else, but even under Schaefer, you know, SU was still recruiting in the high 60s to mid 50s, class-wise, to getting into, you know, the low 50s, and I think we finished 50th or 51st for a couple of those years. And you look at the Marone team that would have happened after he left after the Pinstripe Bowl. That team was well on track to have a top 40 to 45 recruiting class. So, like, BC jumped into the top 50, I think, once in the last 8 years or so. But otherwise, like, this is a program that just is not recruiting at a level you need to succeed. And, like, that's where you draw the line between SU and BC, and you draw the line between a Duke and a Syracuse, is that, you know, Duke right now, the last 2 years now, has been recruiting at a top 40 level. And while this year's Duke team looks like a disaster, that's going to pay dividends at some point. Just like SU's ability to recruit at a top 50 to 60 level, while not amazing in a national standpoint, is still far and away better than what you see BC being able to put together over a long-term stretch recently.
Right. And bringing up Vegas, by the way, I will say, like, literally the only reason I'm not, like, totally confident in us in Syracuse winning this game is that Vegas line came out and it made absolutely no sense, and that is a giant red flag.
Yeah, because we said this going into the USF game last year.
Yep.
And that was bad. BC had a bye, which helps. Their last game was against Clemson, and they didn't really try in the second half, so they basically got an extra half bye weekend. Good for you guys. We had to play a very physical, tough, fast Virginia Tech team this past week in the Dome. And then weather. Weather is probably going to rear its ugly head one way or another. I'm less worried about the rain. I'm more worried about the wind.
Right.
We're looking at 25 to 30 mile per hour winds in this game, potentially. And that, especially when we're going against it, is going to derail this passing game. And that is really where I'm most concerned, given what we saw in a kind of fruitless game against Wake Forest, where we had one kind of spurt where it wasn't raining too hard and we seemed to understand how to move the offense down the field. But otherwise, the running game didn't work because we insisted on using backs who were my size instead of a guy who's a little bit bigger in Jordan Fredericks. And we refused to avoid throwing the ball downfield when that really wasn't an option. And I just hope we learned our lessons there.
Yeah. And I think the line's even more perplexing when I don't even think the weather was really factored in. I don't know that we had a forecast when this dropped, at least not the forecast that we saw today.
Yeah.
So, I still think Syracuse should win this game based on what we've seen from these two teams. But when Vegas is like, oh, yeah, 6-point BC favorite, I get there at home, but that's a 3-point swing. I'm a little nervous.
Connolly's lines. David Hale actually. Connolly's lines 4.5.
Yeah, I actually saw that too. Like, I'm just it makes me a little nervous. And I actually saw, I think David Hale in ESPN's picks, like, basically said, I'm only picking BC because the line is weird. And like, I totally get it. Like, 1,000% with him on that logic. I just couldn't pull myself to not pick Syracuse with the points. So we'll see. I mean, hopefully this is like one of those rare Vegas didn't know and just stared everyone into betting Syracuse and then lost some money on it situations.
Yeah, I mean, it very well could be. I know when I talked to AJ, he said 34-10 Syracuse wins. I don't think that's going to happen. I said 33-24 when I talked to BCI. I'm going to revise that for our prediction to go up tomorrow just because I did that without weather being a factor. I letdown games are real.
Yes, that's the other factor.
They're very real. I saw the Cordell Hudson still out, which there's two different perspectives on that absence.
Davon Ellison was really good.
Davon Ellison's fantastic.
Yeah,
Hudson.
He's had a bigger role.
Yeah, Hudson being out gave way to. I think Carl Jones has actually done a really. He's going to be a guy that we're going to want to talk about after the season, as someone who really stepped up. I mean, he didn't play out of his mind. He's not going to put up a stat sheet that wows you, but I think considering what he had to deal with and what he's had to be kind of pushed into right away, as a fairly green defensive back at the collegiate level, I don't really have any qualms about how he's played so far.
Yeah, this also actually, I know we have a bye after this, right?
Yes. That's why I take my one Saturday off per year, is I plan my entire Saturday off for the bye.
After the bye is Clemson. I don't know if that still counts as the old, like, solid verbal letdown look ahead.
Nope.
If not for the bye, it would definitely be a letdown look ahead. I don't know. We have to consult Dan Rubens and Ty on that.
Well, I mean, I don't know why we'd be looking ahead to Clemson, knowing what's in store.
I mean, they played Clemson close two years in a row. Maybe they think this will be the year with the new offense and stuff. I don't know that I buy it.
Yeah.
Maybe this is like the old, like, whenever we play Notre Dame, we got to call G-Rod back up. Maybe we get Schaefer in the building, see if we could keep it close. And then only have Baber come back whenever it's like a punting situation where Schaefer would punt it from the 36.
That was the moment. I said, I remember it was the Pitt game, and I was talking to you. I said, "We're done. I'm absolutely done." This was the Greg moment.
And it's gone.
Yeah, and there it is. Like, and hopefully that moment never happened. Because you know what? That moment never happened with Marone. That moment, I'd be shocked if that moment ever happened with Babers. Because if you're going to base your entire... I mean, Marone did some conservative things, but he never did... I don't recall anything that was so perplexingly conservative that it was counterintuitive to winning.
Yeah, Marone would punt really conservatively, but generally it was in a close game.
Right.
And not one that, like, is on the brink of falling apart. Like, not one where it's like, you have to go for this or you have no chance of winning. It would be like, Marone would punt, like, from really short distances and do stupid things, but it wasn't like, the game is on the line. If you don't score on this drive, you're going to... Okay, he punted.
we were done here.
I just kind of wish Schaefer had just said after the game, Riley Dixon's our best player, and we decided to put the ball in the hands of our best player.
That's
and,
fine.
And it's like, oh, well, I guess he did that.
Yeah, the one, like, and that's the thing. Like, if the Wake Forest game never happens again, because I had some questions last week, and I brought them up on the podcast about some decision-making and some calls that were made while the game was still a little bit in doubt. But if that never happens again, we're good. Like, then, you know, it was a one-off thing. We just didn't have the horses to run in the rain. And that's, again, it is what it is. If SU goes 5-7 and makes a bowl game via APR, fine. If we go 4-8 and everyone remembers that crazy locker room video, that's cool too. Like, at this point, and Sean said this the other day, Babers has done everything he was supposed to do. At this point, everything else is a nice to have, not a need to have, because he already pulled off something that Scott Schaefer never did.
Yeah, I think the rest of this year, I think beating BC is something that is reasonable to expect and would be a nice step. If it doesn't happen, it's not the end of the world. Ditto, like NC State would be a nice scalp, but if it doesn't happen, it's not the end of the world. So I think the BC is the last game where I think Syracuse should be. I mean, they're not favored, but
there's a reasonable expectation the last that game, they could win.
Right, and NC State, if they beat BC, then maybe you say NC State, like, they're not, you know, it'll be an upset, but it'll be very mild.
I think State's overall, actually better than we gave them credit for. I mean, and I don't know why.
It's possible.
I've watched them enough that I still, and yet I still don't understand, like, what, like, there's, like, I still don't understand what NC State does well enough, because I feel like what that is different in every game.
Yeah, they just don't make any sense. There's also a chance that Clemson game was, like, the last 2 years against us, like, that Clemson just didn't know, like, Clemson's had that every year under Swinney. Like, they usually win those games, but they've had those weird, like, what was Clemson doing games.
Yeah, and that was probably last week.
Maybe that was last week.
Yeah.
Or maybe State's decent. Who knows? That, like you said, like, if we could identify, like, why State was okay most weeks, like, it would make sense. But it really feels like they just, like, rotate through profiles of teams, but they're always about the same, like, in terms of ability. It's just they do just, it doesn't make sense in terms of, like, style or anything.
Right.
But yeah, I think overall, like, BBC would be really awesome, rivalry game, etc. And then just having, like, good process throughout the rest of the year, being exciting, show, you know, give fans reason to get excited going into next year. Obviously, you don't want to end the season on a 4-game losing streak, but it's not really what this year is about, even with the win over Virginia Tech. So, like you said, I think it'd be hard to not count year one under Babers as a success in terms of what the reasonable expectations were going in.
And keyword is reasonable here.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that said, BC is winnable. NC State is confusing. And I am so emotionally and mentally scarred by facing Pittsburgh in football or basketball that I cannot reasonably ever expect a win. But if we get some random 55-degree heat wave in the middle of November down in Pittsburgh, I mean, their defensive backs are trash.
Yeah, and there's not going to be a great crowd, because I don't remember the last time there was a good crowd for a Syracuse Pitt game.
It's because when they had the goddamn game every year.
Right.
At this point, just throw it in week two. Nobody cares. You'll probably get a better crowd from both parties than what you've tried to do with it the last few years.
Yeah, I agree. But yeah, that's the path. Like, if you can beat BC and then you can beat NC State, then that Pitt game, it's going to be like the 2011 Pitt game. Obviously, you get to the 5-6 record much different ways, but actually not that differently, because like, the West Virginia win and the, it's just different part of the program's in a different place, because right. You were coming off a bowl that one time. This time you're like in a total rebuild first year under a new coach.
And you didn't start 5-2.
Yeah, and you're hoping that Chandler Jones isn't going to pick up a pass and have a clear lane to the end zone, but be too hobbled to take it all the way. I was at that game. I was one of the low-key, more miserable losses that I attended at Syracuse.
I told myself we were losing. Like, I was watching, but I was like making sure I was doing something else at the time because I didn't want to be invested. I told myself it was happening the entire time.
The bus ride back from Pittsburgh was a very long bus ride back from Pittsburgh, I will say. Yes. So, if Syracuse does do a bowl this year, it will be like a monumental achievement, and Dino will hopefully not get offered $7 million a year by Purdue.
There's just no. There's no way. And he's smart enough to know that, like, the bones, like, you know, it's like, as someone who owns a house, when you walk into a house, you want to make sure the bones are there. You want to make sure that the place isn't going to fall apart if you start doing some demo. You want to make sure that you don't have to overhaul the entire kitchen. If Dino walked into Purdue, he's going to knock on a few walls and realize that the wood here is made of paper. I have to gut the entire electric, and I have to redo the kitchen, like, on day one.
Yes, because the Big Ten winds are blowing, and the whole house might blow away at any moment. Where Syracuse, for all the shit we give Scott Schaefer, and justifiably so, Dino was given a much better situation in Syracuse than he would be if he was to go take the Purdue job. And not there have even been rumors. Like Bud mentioned it in a column today, and that's kind of why I brought it up. But I think the chances of Dino taking that job are very low, unless you're very scared about Big Ten money, which is a factor. It wouldn't be like the craziest thing that's ever happened in college football, but it isn't something I'm very concerned about, because I think Dino being, not an older coach, but like, you know, he's old in his 50s. Like, he's old enough. He's a veteran. Like, he knows you can't make that jump. If he gets offered something crazy, like
Texas offered you, yeah, sure.
Yeah, like, then you go. Then you just go. You don't think about it. You just go. If you like Purdue, that's just, they might pay more. They probably would pay more. But yeah, like, is it worth it to have to try to rebuild that thing in 3 years and deal with the expectations that'll probably be put forth if you were given a bid contract that trumps what Syracuse is going to offer? Probably not. So I think there's a good chance that Dino will be fairly reasonable if that time comes. And if that time comes, it means he's probably impressed a lot of people on the way, kind of like Marone did. Obviously, Marone didn't fill like the obvious NFL coach profile when he got that job, and a lot of people questioned it, but he, we all knew he was a good coach, and he proved it in his, 2 years in Buffalo? Like, he, until this last 4 weeks, like, it looked like Rex Ryan was nowhere near as good for that job as Marone is, and the jury's still out on that. So, obviously, well, that's a problem that I don't think will present itself this year, not to scare everyone by bringing it up.
And his buyout's huge, if I recall.
I don't remember off the top of my head, but
I want to say his buyout is pretty enormous on his end, like in the first few years.
Yeah, and that would be a lot to, like, if Syracuse goes, like, 4-8 this year, but it's, like, an impressive 4-8 like we're talking about, like, where you can kind of see where things are going, I don't think that's going to be – that's still not the profile of a coach that you're going to, like, make giant financial moves to get. And most of the programs that are going to be able to offer the money, like Trump card money, are going to be ones that can also go get like a Lane Kiffin or someone else that's a little trendier, even with Babers, you know, having a profile that will be kind of impressive.
I concur. So for the last few minutes, why don't we just talk a little prediction action? I know we both kind of chatted through where we thought this game was going to go, but Dan, factoring in some weather, you know, maybe how do you see this one shaping up, and then a final score?
So having been at the Wake Forest game, I cannot imagine, no matter what happens, that the weather is going to be as bad as that was.
Yeah.
I'm going to take Syracuse to win 21-17. I think Wake is probably a better team than BC, and has a little more going for it on offense, and just had that power running game going. I think BC is going to struggle against an improving defense. I think Syracuse will not have the most sterling offensive game of all time, citing the weather. But I think it'll be, I think they'll find a way to get, you know, 3 touchdowns on the board. And I think we'll see another nice defensive performance. And it'll probably be a game that we, you know, we're probably going to feel a little annoyed down the stretch. But I think the team will hold on to get its record up to 4-4, and we'll feel all pretty good at the end of it.
Fair enough. Yeah, I think this one's going to be a lot like the UConn game. There's going to be some aggravation, some frustration, some questions. There's at least going to be weather as a factor in this one, so then you won't be as apoplectic, perhaps, if something stupid happens. Like I said, I originally said 33-24 on BCI. I'm going to revise that, given the weather, to... I'm going to go 28-24. And I'm not going to like it. But it's going to be a win, and that's what matters.
Yeah, well, hopefully we're right, and it isn't, I mean, I don't know. If we lose to BC, it won't be like we said, it won't be the end of the world, but I do feel like for, like, the couple hours afterwards, we're going to probably not be all that happy about it, and then hopefully by podcast time next week, if that happens, we'll have understood things and grasped things a little better. But I do feel confident. I think we'll win this game.
Same. All right. Dan, anything else you wanted to get off your chest before we depart for the week?
No, I think we got everything. I'm excited. I feel better about Syracuse football now than I have probably since after that Minnesota game, where it's like, oh, yeah, we are moving forward in the Marone era, the post-Marone era, in the direction that we thought we would. So obviously that didn't work out, but it seems like we have something totally different, and something that should keep on building. So very exciting. Did not expect it, and I'm very glad to have Syracuse football on the in the national headlines and on the minds of important college football people this week. It's a nice change.
Cheers to that. All right. That was Dan. I'm John. Thanks for listening to Troy Noon's An Absolute Podcast. You can rate, review, subscribe on iTunes, on Blog Talk, wherever else you might listen to us. And go Orange.
Go Orange.